the Tinniswood as the family head to France and Papa calls les shots once again.
Winston is a free man.
Hallelujah! His wife has divorced him.
Winston is a free man. The husband is dead.
Long live the husband.
There is now no impediment to stop Winston and I becoming man and wife and leading a life of radiant romance and glamour and unrestrained passion. Although I will expect him to keep out of the way when I entertain chums from the Old Girls Association. I'm not having him making rude noises and picking bacon fat out of his navel in the presence of Celia Loxton and her dandy Dinmont Terriers. When I put the proposition of marriage to him the morning we set off on our travels in the automatic Volvo, he sort of slucked through the gap in his two front teeth and sort of stared at the ground and shuffled the beige and flamingo pink trainers I'd bought him specially for his feet, and he said,
"Nope."
What's that? Could you be slightly more specific, Winston?
Yes.
Well then, will you marry me?
No. The answer is no.
I can't stand people who don't know their own minds. That's the whole trouble with God. I'm no theologian, but I don't think he knows whether he's Arthur or Martha. Look at the last Archbishop of Canterbury. If God's as omniscient as he cracks up to be, why has he made such a hash of the new Radio Times? Don't start me on that one. Enough of that. Compose yourself, Nancy. We are currently staying temporarily in a place which I like to call France. France is situated on the opposite side of the English Channel. Isn't that typical? Trust the French to be different from us. Why are we staying in France, you ask? Why do we do anything in our family? Because of Father. That's right, we're in France because of Father. It's quite simple. Father decided he wanted to make a grand tour of Europe to relive the memories of a trip he once made years ago with Mother and Uncle Skoma, whoever he is. I don't like the sound of him one little bit. I bet he had long, damp, musty yellow toenails and skin like flypaper. We set off for Europe in the automatic Volvo with our water purification tablets and Father's punt gun and our letters of accreditation from the Independent Ratepayers Association. Well, I wasn't going to be caught short if he bumped into President Mitterrand. Anyway, we had only just disembarked from that ghastly hovercraft gadget. It was like travelling in the bowels of a supermarket floor cleaner. And we'd driven 5 miles on what was the wrong side of the road to us when Father said,
"I say, chaps, I'm feeling homesick."
And all of us, Rosie, William, Winston, and my good self in my stout English brogues and my wasp-proof underskirt, cried out at the top of our voices,
"What?
I'm feeling homesick. I want to go home. Take me home, chaps, please. Please take me home."
Oh, my God, it's started already. The happy family strikes again.
I gave Rosie one of my very special glares, and she turned into the courtyard of this small hotel in the middle of nowhere. It was quite disgusting. The proprietress looked like an extra in a Channel 4 documentary on inbreeding. Well, so does Egon Roney, if it comes to that. Winston humped our luggage up to the bedroom on his broad, firm, muscle-rippling, sun-bronzed shoulders. My heart turned over, and I felt a tingle in my loins and a stirring in my breasts as he hoisted up William in his arms, stepped over the snarling, yellow-gummed, crazy-eyed dog snarling in the doorway, and deposited him in the bedroom.
"Look at the bed. It's as high as a trolley bus. What's that? Oh, dear God, there's a hen roosting in the washstand."
"Is there, William? I tell you what, my old whimsy bat. I'll just nip down to the car, fetch your old dad's punt gun, and we can have a rare old bit of sport tonight."
I took Winston to one side. I pressed my body close to his in the dark, creaky floored corridor. And the spider's webs caressed my cheeks as I whispered softly to him, "Winston, you don't need Father's punt gun to have a bit of sport with me tonight. Just bring your own weapon to my bedroom, and we'll romp and cavort all rampant and naked and slucking our flesh in tandem and abandon and..." "Where are you going, Winston?"
"Me, missus? I wants to go home, Nancy."
"What?"
"I wants to go home to Winterleaf Gunner and the old pool by the trout hatchery where me and the missus used to spodge around all naked except for our daps and our Zippo lighters. And, oh, leave us alone, Nancy. Please, Nancy.
Please.
After I'd thoroughly checked the wardrobes for intruders and footpads and fumigated the beds with my portable spray for Lavis Mills, we went down to dinner. Dinner. Fish soup with the heads on and all those glassy eyes staring at us reproachfully. Well, it wasn't my fault they'd been born as fish. And then Father sighed deeply, rubbed his tummy and said,
Fearfully pleasant lost chaps.
I thought that meal was absolutely appalling. Disgusting. Horrendous.
So did I, Rosie. Poor bloody Charlie, that grubby that made old LaRue's gastronomy turn over in his gravy, that he would without a shadow of a doubt. I sucked more tastier infected balaclavas than that even when I wasn't hungry.
All right, all right. There's no need to make a song and dance about it. It'll all be over in the morning. Assuming they have such an institution in France. Tomorrow, first thing, we'll be up and away back to England. Just think, everyone. There'll be the last night of the prompts every night of the week. Though I hope they get rid of that awful twerp who stands in the front row of the audience conducting the orchestra with his Adam's apple. Another Welsh rabbit for tea and manageresses of shoe shops with cheap jack charm bracelets and brown wizened ankles.
And bits of fluff on the side with gum boils and double chins and strident voices what rouse the ashtrays in my motor, my car lot.
Winston.
Yes, Mrs.
We don't want to know about your bits of fluff, thank you.
Oh, I rather thought you might under the circumstances, love.
What circumstances?
The circumstances of our temporary residence in the nation, what spawned the novels of Gustave Flaubert, and the poetry of Baudelaire, and the paintings of Renoir, and the music of Delibes, and the pensée sort of thing of Théophile Gautier, what is generally recognised by the cognoscenti and them in the know as the prime apostle of art for art's sake. Romantics, Nancy. The whole lot of them. Romantics with mistresses. Bits of fluff on the side. With black velvet chokers and long white legs to wrap round your neck like a serpent's coils.
That's all very well, but I bet they never paid their paper bills on time. I bet they were forever in trouble with the MOT people.
Lost, Nancy. A lost soul, that is what you are, my old Wingsy Bash.
And with that he got up from the table, slow and stately, tossed the dimp of his cigarette into the scum-sodden remains of the fish soup and strode purposefully out of the room, his beige and flamingo-pink trainers slurping manfully on the stew-streaked floor. I was distraught. I was devastated. And so I put Father to bed. I gave him a brisk rub-down with antifreeze and sluiced his knees with Harpic. He sighed again and smiled softly.
Back home in the morning, eh, Nancy?
That's right, Father.
Back home to Blighty and London peace supers, and Ona Wynne eating caviar and blinis in the Savoy Grill with Henry Cotton and Bobby Locke. My God, how I hate plus fours.
That's right, Father. That's right. Now close your eyes, lie back on your pillow, relax, and go to sleep. Let Mr. Sandman take you by the hand and lead you to the land of Nod.
Good old Mr. Sandman. You can buy gift vouchers off him for death, you know.
What?
I once knew a Mr. Sandman when your mother and I lived in Mandalay. He was a travelling salesman in banisters. Not much call for banisters in Mandalay in those days. Cough drops, no. That was another matter. The Burmese were addicted to cough drops, you know. Oodles and oodles of sputum in Burma in those days. I've always been prone to homesickness, Nancy.
Have you, Father?
All those travels your mother and I made round the world, and I was always homesick.
Were you, Father? Shall I take your spats off?
Oh, the sights I've seen. The fisherwomen of Copenhagen skinning the eels alive at the harbour market. The tropic sun setting the spices to bed in Zanzibar. The moon carving great crescents in the soaring buttresses of the Hindu Kush. George Headley scoring a ton at Kingston. Or was it Port of Spain? And I was always homesick.
Poor Father. Would you like me to rub your chest with salad dressing?
When your mother, Uncle Scoma and I made our grand tour of Europe, I was most frightfully homesick. I remember staying in this pension in Florence.
was run by a most refined elderly lady from the Medway Valley, which bore the most remarkable resemblance to the late Titch Freeman of Kent and England. Well, your mother and Uncle Scomer went out for the evening. "We are going to see the frescoes," she said to me. "I expect you want to go AWOL when it comes to seeing frescoes," she said. "So they left me alone, Nancy, in the pension with the elderly lady from the Medway Valley. You know, she told me the most fearfully interesting stories about Musso the Wop. Apparently, he had an insatiable penchant for ballroom dancing. He had all the works of Victor Silvestre specially translated into Italian. I wonder what the Wop say for slow, slow, quick, quick, slow. They didn't come home that evening, your mother and Uncle Skuma. When I came down to breakfast next morning, they were sitting at the table, giggling and grinning and tucking in. That's why I'm homesick now, Nancy. Memories of that breakfast, and they were giggling and grinning and tucking into. I'm homesick, Nancy, yet I don't want to go home. A fearful place, home, even though your mother is long since dead.
Close your eyes, Father. Go to sleep. It'll all be over in the morning.
That's right, Nancy. That's what I used to say to myself all those years ago, when I used to go to bed with your mother when she was alive.
I went downstairs. The whole place was deserted. I went outside. Owls hooted. They hooted just like our boys, cheeky bastards. I could feel the chill breath of the channel breezes on my cheeks, and I knew that over there on the other side my compatriots would be mending fuses, disputing their telephone bills and ogling calendars of nude women. Gulls mewed and bleated. And then I saw it. A faint light shining in one of the downstairs windows of the hotel. Oh, my God, I thought. Father's gone downstairs for a nocturnal tinkle, and he set his spats on fire. I dashed back to the hotel, regardless of sleeping adders and hunting weasels. I fumbled my way inside. Father? Father? I called. There was no response. And then I heard this voice say,
Nancy. And here, Nancy, opposite the door for blokies and messieurs.
I groped my way along the corridor. I trod in something disgusting. It felt like terminal blancmange. Suddenly, I saw a faint light skulking shiftily under a door. I opened the door softly and stepped inside. It was a bar. The proprietress was slumped asleep, her head resting on the sloping zinc counter. And there, in the far corner, sitting at a table lit by a hissing hurricane lamp, was Winston.
Hello there, Nancy. What do you reckon? Not a lot.
I went over and sat opposite him. On the table was a bottle of wine and two glasses.
I knew you'd come eventual, Nancy.
Did you want me to, Winston?
Yes.
Why?
Have a glass of wine, Nancy.
Thank you. I like the sound of wine pouring into a glass of wine, Winston.
Yeah? Why?
Because it's like the sound of love gushing into a woman's body. Do you remember when your love gushed into me, Winston?
Yes.
Was it vintage, Winston? Was it the full-bodied, juicy, tangly, sharp and spicy red wine of rampant passion?
I'm not sure, Mrs. By the way, I was feeling at the time, look, I reckon it might have been slightly corked.
Winston!
It's a bit of a caper, this, isn't it, Mrs.?
Caper? What do you mean, caper?
You and me, you're alone in foggy land. You and me sharing a bottle of wine at dead of night sort of thing in the country, what is known the world over as the birthplace of love and passion and unbridled romance sort of thing.
I know. Let's make the most of it, Winston. Now, here, this very minute.
Hold on. You hold on, Mrs. I don't want you making a bugger of my croque monsieur, do I?
Your croque monsieur? Oh, Winston, show me your croque monsieur and
I'll... He's a sort of Welsh rare bit, Nancy, with a bit of stale ham stuck in the middle. Old Madame Bovary there knocked it up for me before she conked out through swinging brandy with her teeth out. God, blimey, Charlie, tis like eating a stair carpet from a Gaumont cinema. I'd sooner suck the usherette's torch any day of the week.
Winston.
Yes, Nancy.
Why don't you want me?
Well, I does, Nancy. I does. But But not now.
Why?
Because the time ain't propitious. It ain't right, look.
Why? Ever since you first came into my house at Winterleaf Gunner all those years ago, you've been bursting your boilers to have me. You've pursued me, Winston, relentlessly. You've propositioned me in the most explicit terms.
We know that.
Then why not now?
Nancy, you're a child when it comes to matters of the heart, ain't you?
What?
You're a great big gushing schoolgirl.
Don't call me gushing.
When I first paid court to you, Mrs., you was unavailable. I had a missus, and owing to the laws of jurisprudence and legal what's-his-names, it was both ipso facto and de jure sort of thing, impossible for me to take you as my lawful wedded wife.
But you took me as one of your bits of fluff.
Precisely, Nancy, spot on. But I can't now, can I? A man can only have a bit of fluff when he's married, can't he? And I ain't married to the missus now, am I?
Then marry me, Winston. Marry me now. And when you're married, you can be unfaithful to your heart's content.
What?
You can be unfaithful to me, Winston. I can be your bits of fluff as well as your wife. We can go away for weekend breaks with Trust House 40, with matching luggage and full tea-making facilities and morning papers inclusive. We can make love in our hideaway thatch cottage built of Chilmark stone with a navy blue arga in the kitchen and slim volumes of my beloved Rupert Brooke on our DIY simulated oak bookshelves. Oh, summon me by bells, Winston. Summon me by your bells.
It was John Betjeman, Nancy.
What?
It wasn't Rupert Brooke what wrote Summon by Bells. It was John Betjeman, Nancy.
You pig, you swine, you bastard. I jumped up from the table. I positively leapt at Winston. I swear I was going to grasp him by the throat and throttle him to death until his eyes bulged out of their sockets and his tongue turned blue. And at that moment, the door burst open and Rosie and William burst in. Rosie switched on the light and her blonde hair was glowing and her eyes were sparkling and she looked simply stunning.
We found it, Nancy. We found it.
Found what, Rosie?
The house.
What house?
The house where we can live for the summer. We don't have to traipse all over Europe now. We can stay put and live like natives. And Father will be able to listen to Brian Johnson making mistakes on the wireless. And
it's a wonderful house, Nancy. Oh. You'll adore it. And, Nancy, it's an old railway station.
What?
Yes, it's an abandoned railway station, Nancy. No, they've closed down the line, but the buildings are still intact.
But there's the station master's house, and it's got a front parlour with oak beams and an old cast-iron stove in the kitchen.
And it's still got points.
What?
Well, we've still got the lever frames for the points, Nancy. And there are signal gantries and a box where they work the level crossing.
I wish I had old uncle what worked a level crossing.
Yeah?
He lived in this little cottage, like this little hovel, next to the tracks. He was very like me, very partial to his bits of fluff on the side, see? The trouble was, every time he had one in court process, your father and panting uncontrollably for her nookie, he had to get up, put his pants on and close the gates for the 10:35 up non-stopper to St. David's. I always thought there was something deeply phallic in that sort of thing.
No, Nancy, I've always wanted to live in a station. It's been my life's ambition. I can pretend I'm the station master. I can pretend I'm the ticket collector. And the porter who unloads the mail and fills the guard's van with boxes of pullets and crates of crab apples and... Oh, Nancy, what do you say? Can we go and live there for the summer?
Of course we can, William. It doesn't matter what Nancy says. We are going to live in the station master's house, William, and that is that. I have spoken.
I went to bed sombre of heart, remorseful of soul, and covered from head to foot in homeopathic anti-flea ointment I'd read about in the special witch guide for insect repellent. I left the door unlocked. I was hoping, I was longing, I was praying that Winston might rise from his bed in the annex above the stables and silently tiptoe along the long, sullen corridors But he never did. Oh, Winston, with your Zapata moustache and your nut brown boozer's belly and your... Well, of course I know it was John Betjeman who wrote the poetry of Rupert Brooke. Everyone knows that. Everyone that's educated, that is. And I am an educated woman. I've been to Europe 16 times, and that's more than he has. I bet he never tasted genuine Toblerone in Switzerland before he was old enough to wear a bra. I bet he... I'm an educated woman, and I know what's what. And I want Winston. Oh, how I want Winston. I'm a desirable woman, and I want a man I can love and cherish. Never mind Dennis Lotis. I want Winston. And I don't give a jot if he's never seen Cosy Van Tutti sung by Mozart in the original French. Next morning,
much against my will, I should add. I allowed myself to be driven in the automatic Volvo by Rosie to see the house. I must say it was quite nice. If you shut your eyes and thought about England, it could have even been like the converted Oast house Honor Masefield and her husband bought in Kent from that advert in House and Gardens. Swanky devils. I know for a fact they never eaten an Oast in their lives till then. When Father saw the old broken-backed signal box, he clapped his hands together and said,
"They say, chap's a shed."
"It's not a shed, Father. It's a signal box."
"Oh, so much the better, old boy. I can incarcerate myself in there all day and send out signals to all the chaps I knew when I was young and in my prime."
Much against my will, I allowed myself to be driven into town to see the agent who rented out the property. I must say, he was quite dishy. He looked like Placido Domingo, if you closed your eyes and thought of Donald Piers. He kissed my hand and held me lightly round the waist as he showed me to my chair. He had a slim gold cigarette case, and he tapped his cigarette firmly on the back of his thumbnail before he lit it. I like men who do that. I like men who lean forwards across the table and stare into your eyes and glance down at your breasts and raise their eyebrows softly. I took a swift glance at Winston, and he looked livid. "Right then," I said to myself, "that's it, we'll take it." I smiled sweetly at the agent in his powder-blue suit and his bottle-green silk shirt and his white tie and his ice-calf shoes with the gold buckles, and I said, "We'll take it. We'll rent the property for the whole of the summer." I would have said it in his language if only I'd remembered the French for monsieur. And so that afternoon we moved into the station master's house. Rosie was ecstatic.
"Oh, this is sheer bliss. I shall spend all day in the orchard painting, and I shall romp in the fields among the poppies, and I shall..."
"Have tantrums with a lavatory chain, and throw fits of temper with a meat saver." "No, you won't, Rosie. You'll be calm and loving, and I'll be... Oh, crikey, I've just got to explore. I'm sure I'll find an abandoned shunter's pole if I only look hard enough."
Father potted happily among the ducks and the hens in the yard, and threw his duty-free smarties into the pond, and burnt a hole with his pipe in the brim of his Panama hat. And Winston? Winston skulked, and he slouched, and he sulked, and he said,
"These are your hens, missus. You've got to be fed, you know."
"I know, Winston. That's the thing about hens, isn't it? They've got to be fed, haven't they? And so has the love of a good woman. He got to be fed, ain't he, my old Winsy Bash?" We had just finished supper, and Father was dunking his tie in the remains of his vinaigrette, when William burst through the door.
"Look what I've found! A treasure chest! A positive cornucopia!"
"What is it, William?"
"I found an old chest in the station master's office. Old working manuals, ticket prices, duty rosters, and, Father, timetables."
"Timetables? I say, old boy, I adore timetables. 1 4 is 4, 2 4s are 8, 3 4s are something or other."
"No, Father, not that sort of table. Tables for the times of trades. Don't you see what this means?"
"I haven't a clue, old boy. Tell me."
"It means we can make your grand tour of Europe, and we don't even have to leave the house. We can do it through the timetables."
"I say, what a wheeze, what a laugh. Begged I sit facing the engine."
We cleared the table and washed the pots. I learned that expression when we lived in full view of the Manchester Ship Canal. And then we settled down in the old warped front parlour with its scrunchy sofas and its threadbare threatening carpet. And William said,
"Right then, Father, when you started off on your grand tour with Mother and Uncle Scoma, where's the first place you went to?"
Paris, old boy. Or was it Trieste?
We'll make it Paris. On the Arlberg Express.
Yes, splendid. Has it got a restaurant car?
Hold on, Father. Let's look it up. Oh, yes, there's the old crossed knife and fork symbol. Right, Boulogne Maritime depart 1412, arrive Etap 1441, arrive Amiens 1539, and arriving Paris Nord 1654. All aboard!
I say. Well, it's a fairly comfortable train.
Oh, wonderful. Clerestory stock, I think.
Do you mind if I open a window?
Be our guest, Father.
Do you mind if I smoke?
Fire away, Father.
I say, what fun. You know, it's at times like this that a chap has an irresistible urge to pull the communication cord.
I left them to it. I went outside. I crossed the ghosts of the old tracks and headed down the chalky path that led down the cliffs to the beach. The sun smacked the waves and the clouds scudded and gulls wheeled and silly ships shimmered on the horizon. When I turned away from the wind to wipe a grain of sand from my eye, I saw Winston standing behind me.
Winston!
Hello there, Nancy.
What are you doing here?
Just admiring the view. Do you know what it reminds me of, Nancy?
No, what?
That old painting by Claude Monet, look, 1840 to 1926, entitled The Beach at Saint Address.
What?
On the other hand, he do bear a striking resemblance to the masterpiece by Eugene Boudin, 1824 to 1898, entitled and called Approaching Storm.
Oh, Winston, there's no approaching storm between you and I, my love.
You and me, Nancy.
What?
You and me, that is the grammatical way of putting it, if you wants to abide by the rules of grammar sort of thing.
Oh, my gerunds and oxymorons of long ago, they all came flooding back. And I couldn't help myself. I threw myself at Winston and smothered him with kisses.
Steady, steady, Mrs. Steady.
Marry me, Winston. Marry me, marry me. Why won't you marry me?
Do you really want to know why, Nancy? Really, really?
Of course I do, you great booby.
Right then, Nancy. It's very simple. It's because you ain't as educated as what I am.
What? What's that you say?
You ain't educated, Nancy. You knows nothing of the world, of the great impressionist painters, and your knowledge of the literature and the Beaux-Arts of the Second Empire could be wrote down on the back of a worming tablet for a decrepit hamster.
What? What?
And with that he bellowed with laughter, ripped off all his clothes and plunged into the sea. And as I watched him with the water gushing off his naked, nut-brown body and the sunlight glinting in the tawny streaks of his hair, I thought to myself, well, if that's being educated, I'd rather live in an oast house in Kent with Honor Masefield. I wonder if she was related to the famous poet who wrote The Wastelands.